I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 8th of September, 29th. Thank you. Oh, it's just a day, but always a good day. Mostly always a good day. First hour of our program today, President Obama and Russian President Putin had their first formal meeting in more than 2 years. And the news reports today are saying that they left their discussions exactly where they started, that the U.S. is saying Syria's future cannot include Assad. Putin is saying, strange as it may seem, there were many common points. There were also disagreements which we agreed to work together. I hope this will be constructive. So what is the solution to restoring stability in Syria, to stop the flow of refugees, to stop the over 250,000 dead as a result of war in that country? We'll have two guests with us during the course of this hour to talk about that very subject. Mark Schrod is assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Villanova University. He, so many Wisconsin connections with so many guests, received his PhD in political science from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and his expertise includes Russian politics and the politics and foreign policy of the former Soviet states. He is the author of Vodka Politics, Autocracy and Alcohol in Russia. Later this hour, Gregory Pfeiffer will join us, former Moscow correspondent for NPR, who reported from Russia for almost a decade, and he's the author of Russians, the People Behind the Power. Welcoming phone calls from you this hour, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. And our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. We always like to hear from you during the course of our conversations. Professor Mark Schrod, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Well, thank you for having me again.
Have you been able to read many details? I'm just getting sketchy news accounts of what the President of America and the President of Russia talked about for, I guess, a good 90 minutes yesterday.
Right. That's what I've heard as well. And there's not a whole lot of information being publicly released either from the Russian side or from the American side. But it does seem to be that if there was some sort of breakthrough, we probably would have heard something by now. But by all accounts, it is pretty much as you said, that both sides came out of the meeting pretty much where they went into it. The United States demanding that Assad not be part of any sort of negotiation, and Putin very much on Assad's side.
The president said recently that he was encouraged that Mr. Putin, he said, called him a couple of weeks ago and initiated the call to talk about Syria. The president says, I think they get a sense that the Assad regime is losing a grip over greater and greater swaths of territory inside Syria. Is that true?
That I don't know. I'm Syria is not as much my area of expertise as is sort of the Russian side. But you know, as far as I've been looking into, you know, these on the ground realities, is that you know Assad's forces are putting up a fight, you know, for existence, you know, against ISIS and against a number of these other, you know, it's a multi-sided civil war. So I don't think that you know. Assad already had a number of weaponry and had for a long time. I didn't think his regime was immediately in threat of, you know, being toppled anytime soon. So there does raise that question of, you know, strategic initiative on Putin's side. Well, why now as opposed to, you know, a year ago or 2 years ago that, you know, he seems to be ramping up the military assistance to Assad's side.
What is Putin doing by putting weapons, warplanes, tanks, marines at an airfield in Syria? What's the purpose of that?
That's a good question. There's been a lot of speculation about that, you know, in a lot of different areas. Some people say that this is Putin is something of a master of playing a weak hand. So he knows he can't rival America's strategic power around the globe. But what he can do is use his, you know, limited resources very effectively to sort of be an irritant under the skin of the United States and sort of, you know, make things a little bit uncomfortable for Obama. And so making something of a, being something of a troublemaker, making an issue where there might not have otherwise been one, you know, and allowing this issue that's has been roiling for years now, all of a sudden putting it kind of front and center, you know, having the imposition of a foreign power like Russia on the ground in that area.
Mm-hmm. He's probably
militarily, as far as I know, it doesn't really change too much of the strategic balance. I don't think, you know, an additional 24 warplanes or whatever is going to make that, you know, huge of a difference, but I think it's more symbolic action than anything else.
So what's in it for Russia to be allied with Syria and Assad?
For a long time, people looked at the armaments. I mean, Assad has been one of the primary buyers of, Soviet-era weaponry, and now, weaponry from the Russian Federation, which in terms of quality isn't nearly as good as the stuff that's being produced in the United States and even the stuff that's produced in China. For the most part. So we've got a reliable sort of economic partner there. So that's one thing that people look at. But also, I think there's that notion that in terms of the sort of the broader geopolitics that Putin sort of sees himself as this balancer of the United States. And any time that, you know, he sees the United States getting kind of too big for its britches, he wants to be that counterbalance, that counterweight. And so I think Syria is one of those few areas, and potentially Iran being the other one, where Russia has a little bit of leverage, at least more so than the United States does in some of these regards.
Mm-hmm. It is Putin's contention that, and he said this, toppling authoritarian governments in the Middle East has led, he says, only to chaos and sanctuaries for terrorists, direct criticism of the United States. Does he speak the truth in that regard?
You know, it's. I don't want to say that he's, I don't want to get branded as a, Putin loyalist or a stooge or something, but there's a lot of truth that comes out of his statements, and just as there's a lot of truth that comes out of, President Obama's statements. And there's an interesting article by Julie Offe in the in Foreign Affairs that just came online this morning, essentially highlighting the similarities, even though apparently Putin wasn't at the UN when Obama was giving his speech. Apparently Putin was just landing at the airport. But essentially what they said is that if you line up their speeches, there's a whole lot of agreement between them. Just the focus is different. And so, when Putin gets up and he's talking about, defending the United Nations and the institutions of international law and not impinging upon national sovereignty, those are things that, Obama had said, 2 hours before. But he was also, Obama was kind of criticizing Russia with his regards to sort of intervening in the sovereignty of Ukraine, just as, Putin was sort of criticizing the United States for intervening in the Middle East, in Syria, in Libya and so on. So there is sort of a commonality there. And so while they may disagree as to the specific cases, there is some truth to it on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
He also talked about Putin, that is 2,000 Russians who have joined ISIS, and his worries that they may come back to Russia to initiate terrorist attacks. They've already had to fight two wars in Chechnya.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one of the questions that was put out there, one of the justifications for, increased Russian involvement in Syria is that, we essentially, Russia says we want to fight them while they're over there before they come home, and if Russia has suffered a number of terrorist attacks in Moscow, bombings at metro stations and airports and train stations and all sorts of things. And so I think they are really jittery when it comes to questions of sort of a rise in the Islamic fundamentalism coming from their south. And so I think there is a bit of that sort of domestic politics to Putin's decisions, that there is that kind of concern for, the well-being of the homeland as opposed to it just being sort of a foreign policy calculus.
The U.S. leadership and Russian leadership haven't really had a formal bilateral meeting because of what happened in Ukraine. Before we talk about what happened in Ukraine, can they get a lot done with private meetings at the U.N., or do they need to have some kind of formal bilateral meeting that might be more fruitful?
Yeah, I think, while all the cameras are on when you're at the UN, I think a lot of the real legwork is going to be done by, sort of lower level functionaries, mm-hmm. and militaries of the two sides. And so that'll probably occur off camera to be sure. And those will probably be, more fruitful negotiations than what you get between the rather frosty relations between President Obama and President Putin.
And what is going on in Ukraine? It hasn't been mentioned very much this week, and certainly it's been off the front pages of the newspaper, where it was quite prominently, but it's been virtually non-existent news for a long time now.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a great resource. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. It's this Vice News. It's online, vicenews.com or whatnot. They have this intrepid reporter, Simon Ostrovsky, who reports and has been reporting for the last 3 years or so consistently from the front lines of Ukraine. They put out 100 or so of these sort of video dispatches. And the most recent one, from earlier this week, suggested that there's been something of a change in the tone of these breakaway republics, the Luhansk People's Republic and so on, that you're starting to get more of a rapprochement, and you're starting to get more of these statements that these breakaway republics are willing to stay within Ukraine as long as they are given some degree of autonomy. And those are statements coming now from the leadership of these republics that would have been branded as treasonous just a couple of months ago. And so it seems like there seems to be a softening of tensions there, which is curious, just as there's sort of an escalating of tensions in Syria, it seems like the Ukraine situation seems to be dying down.
Mm-hmm.
And so Ostrovsky in particular spent some time, at these military crossing checkpoints between sort of the rebel-held areas and Ukrainian-held areas. And they said they haven't heard any combat fire for 2-3 weeks now. So it seems that things are getting a little bit more stable, but of course they could flare up again at any time.
Mm-hmm. People are taking note of the fact that Obama and Putin have worked together fairly recently, that they worked in 2013 to forge the accord that called for Syria to give up its chemical arsenal, and also make reference to what happened with Iran nuclear negotiations, which resulted in agreement, Russia, China, and the West. Does that give one hope that some kind of agreement can be worked out to stop this horrible death toll in Syria?
I think there might be some hope. The situation with Syria, at least with the chemical weapons a couple of years ago, seems to have just almost happened by happenstance. It's like both sides kind of stumbled into an agreement while trying to save face with their own domestic audiences. I'm not overly optimistic that something positive is going to come out of this. Because the fact that you now have Putin in the situation here, it seems to give the American administration a bit of an excuse to kind of back off and say, okay, well, now we have to stop and reassess our policy towards Syria because, well, if Russia's there, we don't want to risk confrontation that, could ultimately bring us toe to toe with the Russians. So that might be, another excuse to not, be actively participating in a situation which there really are no easy answers. It's one of the things I hope that comes out of these meetings and these negotiations and the debates around them is the sort of acknowledgement maybe on both sides that, hey, this is a really complex situation. And while we have opposing viewpoints, it's not as though you're going to have one cut and dried answer that's going to just, solve this whole thing. There is no magic bullet here. And so, it might require some reflection on the Americans' part that, our position of arming the non-ISIS, rebel groups in Syria doesn't seem to be working. And it might be time for Russia to realize that backing Assad doesn't seem to be working. So maybe it's time to, admit fault that these things aren't working and try to work cooperatively together to maybe find something that does work.
And there certainly is a sense of urgency for everybody involved to stop this huge flow of refugees.
Yes, to be sure. The migration or the migrant crisis in Europe is it's astounding. Once you look at the sheer numbers of people who are displaced by this, it's really quite astounding.
Mm-hmm. The Russians have been pretty consistent about saying that they're not attached to Assad, but they do say that his government is legitimate and that it is fighting terrorists, and that's the reason for the support.
Right. And this, I think, is something that you can find sort of a traces in in Putin and his personality and sort of his approach to international politics and domestic level politics as well, is that the state ultimately is paramount. And so, you know, he doesn't see any sort of conflict of interest, or doesn't see any contradiction in saying that, you know, well, the United States goes into countries and, you know, into Iraq and so on, and wants to topple governments and leave something of a vacuum in its wake, and then not see the same thing that he's doing in Ukraine, which seems to be meddling in, you know, sort of the sovereignty of another country, because he sees himself as propping up what he saw as the, you know, the duly appointed government of Ukraine in that situation. So for him, you know, the focus is on the government. And so, yeah, maybe he doesn't have any particular attachment to Assad as an individual, but he does see him as sort of the, you know, the representative of the Syrian government, for better or for worse. And he respects the need to not topple him, which is very self-serving because, you know, as a representative of the Russian government, he himself does not want to be targeted for, you know, for regime change, as it were. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one thing that really, really scares him, especially what happened in the streets of Kiev. You know, if you could have a popular uprising that topples the government next door in Kiev, well, what's to stop that from happening on the streets of Moscow? And so, so there is that defense of statehood that I think is a key element of Putin, not only domestic politics, but foreign politics as well.
He still has pretty high approval ratings, though, in Russia, doesn't he?
Oh, yes, yes. And so, you know, his public approval ratings have slipped a little bit since the economy's kind of groaning along under the weight of international sanctions and the drop in the global price of oil. But he's still hovering around in the mid-70s in approval ratings. And so this is an issue that some people have raised on the domestic front, is that, you know, when Russia went in and sort of grabbed Crimea as being part of, you know, this ancient Russian homeland and sort of intervening in Ukraine and nominally in the interest of protecting Russian-speaking citizens and so on, you know, those were very popular moves. And so things that really bolstered his opinion. But public opinion polls in Russia now suggest that 77% of the Russian population is against any involvement in Syria. And so some people see this as potentially a hot potato for Putin on the home front, that, you know, if he's going to put boots on the ground and there's already grumblings from his military that they don't want to go, you know, there have been petitions by Russian soldiers that they don't want to go and die in Syria, that this might risk greater, you know, domestic disturbances at home in Russia.
We welcome phone calls. We're talking about Russian President Vladimir Putin making his first trip to the UN in 10 years, having a chance to have meetings. I guess last night's was about 90 minutes with President Obama as they looked at Ukraine and spent a lot of time talking about the conflict in Syria and what can be done to stabilize that country, to stop the flow of refugees, to stop the deaths. They have very different visions about what needs to happen, but can the United States and Russia forge some kind of an agreement that would help to lessen the strength of ISIS? Is that a possible outcome? Do you think, the audience, and we'll ask our guests this too, as a result of their meetings, is it necessary for them to join forces to take on ISIS? Does it make any difference if Assad is in power in Syria? Is he indeed, as Putin is saying, fighting the terrorists? What a mess this whole thing is, isn't it? And it's tragic in so many ways. We'd like to hear your thoughts on this. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Do you agree with President Obama's position that Syria's future cannot include Assad? Well, we'll be with you in a moment. And with our guest, we have two guests this hour. Our first guest is Mark Schrod, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Villanova University. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's welcome phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. Dimitri in Milwaukee is our first caller for you. Hi, Dimitri.
Hi there.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Thanks for calling.
Yes, so I kind of wanted to comment real quick. I come from Russian heritage. I was actually born in Russia, but grew up in this country. So I have a perspective from both sides, quite a few Russian friends. And I started off with the position that the U.S. was correct in everything that we did, just because we're more exposed to Western media than anything else. But if you take a look at it from the Russian perspective, there's quite a bit of truth there, too. The fact that the Kievan uprising was, for the most part, a U.S.-backed initiative. And if you imagine Russia coming into Canada and essentially promoting an uprising there, you now have a hostile government in Canada. And so the U.S. wouldn't stand for that either. So that's the Kievan position, or the Ukrainian position. And in terms of Syria, that one's interesting because of oil prices. There's arguably no country in the world that benefits more from decreased oil prices than the U.S., and no country that benefits least than Russia when the price of a barrel of oil drops. So there, you know, Putin is definitely protecting his interests in terms of oil prices, and that's where it gets hairy. So that was the comment I wanted to make.
Thanks so much, Dmitry, for your call. Professor Schrod.
Yeah, I think he's right on a lot of points there in terms of the global price of oil. You know, this is something that has really hurt Russia quite badly with the plummeting price of oil. What's interesting, though, is that in the past, if you remember, it seemed that the price of global price of oil always seemed to shoot up whenever there was instability in the Middle East. And not that I'm suggesting that this is some sort of nefarious ploy to stoke, you know, instability to drive up the price of oil, but, you know, that's could possibly play part of it. I don't know. But yeah, that's definitely part of, you know, the political calculus in terms of oil revenues. But yeah, so Russia is, in terms of their own particular views of this, you know, it's hard to, when you're straddling that divide between Russia and the United States, as Dmitry was doing, it's hard to always have, you know, just like one consistent, you know, position, one consistent opinion. And I remember when I used to live in Russia, you know, I was preparing, actually going back to the University of Wisconsin, I was going to teach a course on international law. And I was teaching, you know, I was reading up all these books on international law, and I had some of my Russian friends came over to the apartment. This is like 2005, 2006. And they looked down, and they said, what are these books? And I said, oh, I'm teaching a course on international law. And they laughed at me. They said, well, what could you possibly know? You're an American. Mm-hmm. Americans violate international law all the time. You invade Iraq. You've got Abu Ghraib. You've got Guantanamo Bay. And, you know, you kind of had to suck it up and say, well, yeah, I guess, you know, we have done that sort of thing. And so for a long time, Russia's position, and you kind of see this in Putin's, you know, expressions before the United Nations, he constantly invokes, you know, international law. We need to defend the institution of the United Nations,
right,
because that's where Russia has a veto. And we have to defend international law because those are the instruments that they had. But then, of course, when the situation develops in Ukraine and they decide to go in militarily into Crimea and then intervene militarily in the Donbas region, all of that justification just kind of goes out the window. So, you know, it's that same sort of strategic utilization of international law, you know, except it just kind of comes and goes in these ways between mm-hmm. the United States and Russia.
And let's go to Maddie in Waupaca. Hi, Maddie.
Hi. I never thought that I would see the day that I would be happy about Russia going into anybody else's country. But after what I've seen on TV about the horrible thing that is happening to so many people that are trying to escape the violence, and I am glad they're going in there. And I feel that... you know, a lot of those dictators, if you leave them alone, they seem to leave you alone. It's only when you try to bring them down. But like ISIS, they seem to be the meanest people on earth, and they will not leave you alone unless you do exactly what they tell you to do.
Professor Schrod.
Yeah, and there's something to that. I mean, the stability of the region, and this is kind of, you know, Putin's position is that, you know, if we dig right down to it, you could look next door in Iraq and say, well, you know, Saddam Hussein was a horrible person who did horrible things to his own people and, you know, gassed and murdered many of them, but he kind of kept to himself. You know, it wasn't
Hussein who was behind 9/11 or anything along those lines, right? So, so for Putin, you know, he looks at this and says, well, the United States moves in 2003, knocks over Saddam Hussein, and then what do you get? You get this multi-sided civil war and this, you know, fracturous country, and you know, that spills over into Syria as well, and so you have just a giant mess. And so, again, for Putin, who's the statist, you know, who's all about the importance of the state, he doesn't see a problem necessarily with a leader with a strong hand, you know, doing maybe unspeakably horrible things to his own people, but at least keeping that those atrocities, I guess, to himself, as opposed to exporting them to the rest of the world.
Hmm. Well, nobody seems, I don't know who we talked to get an idea of how successful anybody is in fighting ISIS, but it doesn't seem as though Assad is doing a very good job either, is he?
No, it doesn't. I mean, he's well-armed to the teeth, and it doesn't seem like he's stopping their incursions all that much either. So we'll see if maybe this influx of military hardware does anything. I kind of have my doubts, but it's certainly a possibility.
Thank you so much for being with us, Professor Schrod.
Sure, anytime.
Professor Mark Schrod, our guest first half hour, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Villanova, author of Vodka Politics, Autocracy and Alcohol in Russia. Gregory Pfeiffer is joining us now for the remainder of the show. He is the former Moscow correspondent for NPR, reported from Russia for about a decade. He is the author of Russians, The People Behind the Power, and he's working on a new book about anti-Americanism in Russia and in other countries. Gregory, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. We were talking with Professor Schrod about kind of a lack of information coming from that 90-minute meeting between Obama and Putin yesterday. That's a long time to be talking about Ukraine and Syria. Do you have any more of an understanding of what was talked about, if anything was agreed on, and what it must have been like with those two guys who don't like each other very much having these discussions?
No, certainly. And you could read the body language, I think, loud and clear in the photo ops and the lunch hosted by Ban Ki-moon. They could barely look at each other, as usual, I have to say. I don't have more information than anyone else about what took place, but I can imagine that there were no agreements, because it seems to me that Vladimir Putin's overriding aim, both in Ukraine and in Syria, is to obstruct a solution. His main goal is to do precisely what he's been doing over the past 2 days, appear in headlines in the New York Times and on CNN, and be at the center of attention. He will make some movement toward at least saying that Russia is in favor of a political solution, that Russia wants to see a grand anti-terrorism coalition. But his main goal is, I think, as I said, both in Ukraine and in Syria, to prolong the conflict on the one hand, to complicate the situation on the ground, and generate attention in diplomatic talks. So I don't see how any progress could have been made with those priorities.
Mm-hmm. Does he really believe, do you think, Gregory, that if he helps Assad, who is fighting terrorists with all the equipment that he's brought in and maybe more Russian troops, that they'll be effective?
I don't think so. Again, I think that the whole idea of Putin's here is to complicate the situation for the Western powers. The British have been actively discussing creating safe areas in the north of Syria, which would entail having to enforce a no-fly zone, which is essentially off the table if there's any thought of Russian planes in that airspace. It's well known that both the refugee crisis, the migrant crisis in Europe, and the appearance of ISIS is thanks almost solely to President Assad. So Putin saying that he wants to help solve these problems by continuing to back Assad is well, frankly, laughable.
Yeah. So why does he walk arm in arm with Assad? What's in it for him?
Well, I think there are lots of levels here that he's working on. I don't think that Putin is a grand strategist or actually a strategist at all, but he's an excellent tactician. He makes these diplomatic moves which appear to catch the White House wrong-footed, and he acts very much like a KGB operative. So he will surprise, he will try to use all sorts of intrigue, but I think the idea is to essentially prolong the civil war in Syria, and by doing that, to make Russia, the Kremlin, appear more indispensable to any kind of political solution. And as I said, I think that's the main goal. Of course, Syria is Russia's last Middle East ally. It's a certain amount of prestige for Putin to be at the center of attention in this country. Russia has military bases, a port, and an air base, and there are all sorts of rumors and pictures on social media indicating that there might be a lot more involvement on the ground by Russian troops. Really, it's at the end of the day, this is about Putin's prestige. I don't think he's thinking long term about what's going on in Syria. I don't think he's thought through the ramifications of having ISIS, for example, confront Russian troops on the ground, or having a backlash by extremist militants in the North Caucasus, where there are bomb attacks and shootings almost every day, and where young men have gone off to join ISIS and fight in Syria. I don't think there's a lot of thought about that. It's all about boosting Putin's popularity by showing him to be at the table with Obama, negotiating in Cold War style, and boosting those all-important popularity ratings, his 80%+ of popularity ratings that are crucial for him, and his power back home where the economy is in recession and where the country is increasingly isolated from the rest of the world thanks to Western sanctions and other measures surrounding the violence in Ukraine. Mm.
And yet, how can you ignore 250,000 deaths because of the civil war and these huge numbers of refugees? You can't just not see that, can you, if you're Putin?
No, absolutely. Well, absolutely not. I don't think anybody can ignore that. But I think the sort of salient fact is that Putin, although he says these are the main motives that addressing the refugee crisis and fighting ISIS, I think that's utterly disingenuous because, again, it's Assad who has killed the lion's share of civilians inside Syria, and it's Assad who's to blame for the magnitude of this migrant crisis facing Europe. And of course, without Assad, there wouldn't have been ISIS. So I think he's saying one thing, and I think that the U.S. and other Western countries, by taking him seriously, or at least appearing to take his words at face value, we are playing right into his game.
Let's go to some phone calls for you. We start with Phil in Madison. Hi, Phil.
Hi.
Hi.
I was in Russia, and I was in Finland in 1987 when Khrushchev was in power. And I met a high Russian communist, and he said, please help America free our system for what we have here now. And he said, beware the second man who's in charge in East Germany, Putin. I said, who's Putin? He's going to come to Leningrad, and he's going to take over Russia. And the Russians have taken over lots of lands. Don't blame America for having taken lands. The Russians took over the Finno-Ugric area, Muromo, in Moscow. They were Finno-Ugric, took over the Ingerians from Yanisari, which was the name of the area that became Peter the Great's St. Petersburg. The Finns call him Peter the Bum, and we call him Peter or Putin the Bum.
Gregory.
Being able to tell that Putin would come to power was a tremendous amount of foresight. He must have known something that that others didn't. That's actually quite an impressive prediction. It's absolutely true that before the Slavs, the northern Slavs, that settled the northern forest, the indigenous people were indeed Finno-Ugric. So in that sense, he's absolutely correct. But I will say one thing about the difference between the popular feeling, because of course there was a Cold War. The Soviet Union was the United States' main adversary, and yet most Soviet citizens felt warmly toward the U.S. They didn't like their system. They understood the deprivations. And one of the things that Putin has done successfully, very well, has been to essentially both tap into and at the same time reinforce a real grassroots anti-Americanism. It's genuine, and I think it has to do with a decade of humiliation after the Soviet collapse. People became nostalgic for the lost superpower status. They forgot about the deprivation. And Putin has very skillfully managed to tap into that, more than even I would have thought a couple of years ago, because although that's been he's done that from the very beginning, from when he came to power in 2000, when he started to ban Western food about a year ago in response to Western sanctions over Ukraine, I thought that, well, maybe he's crossed the line, because the conventional wisdom was that for a long time, that as long as living standards continued rising in Russia and that Russians were free to buy whatever they wanted in the stores and travel where they wanted, then most people were okay with the Kremlin being as authoritarian as it liked. Well, it turns out now the economy is going into recession. You can't buy a significant amount of Western food. There's a lot of xenophobia, anti-Westernism, and he's still popular. I think he's tapped into something deeper here, and I think in part he's showing himself to be the real thing, because on the one hand he's posturing on the world stage, he's appearing with Obama, and he's sort of playing at resurrecting the lost superpower status. And that, I think, goes hand in hand. I think this ban of Western food kind of triggers something in the Russian sort of consciousness that maybe he's showing that, well, he's the real deal.
Hmm. Thanks, Phil, for the call. Mohammed in Madison. Hi.
Hello?
Yes, Mohammed. Go ahead.
Yes. I was just curious as to whether or not Putin or Russia's involvement in Syria is more payback for the United States, payback in helping them to be defeated during the Afghan conflict, because it would seem to me he wouldn't want to rile the people. Many of the people who are over there fighting with ISIS are people who were trained, who came to Afghanistan and fought against the Soviets. Who were recently only all dressed up with no place to go before they came and joined up with ISIS. I don't understand why he would be willing to risk his country's involvement in another conflict that's just going to upset more Muslims.
Hmm.
Sure, that's a very good point. I think that it's a new generation of militant extremists in Syria right now. I don't know about the involvement of the former Afghan Mujahideen. I doubt it's very significant. However, I think that it's still a very a valid point, and I think Afghanistan certainly looms large for the Kremlin and for Russians. The fact that the Soviets lost the war in Afghanistan, that it was a bloody a conflict that was humiliating, is very much on the consciousness. And I think one of the things that Putin is being careful to do is, first of all, to have plausible or implausible deniability. The Russians on the ground are doing all these things, just like they're doing in Ukraine, and the government isn't admitting to it. So he does not have to admit to it. But on the other and also, not getting involved so that he isn't able to pull out at a moment's notice. I think you see the same thing again in Ukraine, that although, of course, there are Russian troops and weaponry on the ground, at a moment's notice, if the popular opinion turns against the war in Ukraine, he can pull out and there's no there's no long-term commitment. I think Syria, there's a lot of similar thinking between the Afghanistan war, the Soviet war in Afghanistan, and what Putin is thinking now in Syria. It's seen as a move to increase Moscow's importance in the region, increase its strategic position in this case in the Middle East. And I think it's similarly misguided. One of the big mistakes that the Soviets made during the Cold War was they never really understood that they had inserted themselves in the middle of a civil war in Afghanistan. They always just felt that they were essentially helping shore up a communist government that was already in power and had been asking for help. And I think in Syria as well, they don't quite understand the terrible nature of this civil war. It's almost like it's sort of fun and games for Putin. And at the end of the day, what he's doing is complicating the situation on the ground, making a resolution more difficult. And of course, this has been his modus operandi all along, including with this chemical weapons deal that he brokered more than a year ago. The goal is to shield Assad, keep him in power, keep the conflict going, and thereby boost Russia's significance in the world as a diplomatic and military power.
Gregory Pfeiffer is our guest this part of the show, former Moscow correspondent for NPR. He reported from Russia for almost a decade. He's the author of Russians, The People Behind the Power, and he's working on a new book about anti-Americanism in Russia and in other countries. This hour we're talking about Obama and Putin and whether or not there's something that cooperatively and collaboratively they can do to stop the civil war in Syria and to lessen tensions and diminish the threat of ISIS, a tall order. So far, not much has been accomplished. Do you have faith that it will? What's in both best interest? So we'll take more phone calls momentarily. We have some lines open. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email, talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter, @KDunnShow. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to Cornelia, our next caller from Marshfield. Hi, Cornelia.
Hi. I just wanted to call in when I heard the speaker talk about the anti-American sentiment. I am a first-generation American. My father was Russian. And my husband and I just came back from 2 weeks in St. Petersburg alone. I mean, not on a tour. We were by ourselves. And we were never threatened or in danger in any way, but the anti-American sentiment was very strong. They did not smile at us. They would not look at us. There would be no interaction. If you said, "Do you speak English?" they said, "No." And I've been to Russia before when it was communist, and it was really a different experience this time. So I just wanted to say how it was for us.
Mm-hmm. Gregory.
Well, I'm sorry to hear it. I experienced the same thing myself, and I live in Boston these days, so I'm in Russia less than I would like, and of course it always pains me to hear that. And it's very concerning because there's a generation of young people growing up who are told that the United States wants to topple Vladimir Putin, the Russian government, and seize Russia's natural resources. It's not a joke. This is what Putin and other officials actually say. We'll see what will happen. But the fact that a generation again of young people is growing up under this kind of rhetoric in a country which is increasingly authoritarian, increasingly corrupt. And life is becoming more difficult with a tremendous amount of brain drain because many educated Russians are leaving. All of this makes me think that the effects of what Vladimir Putin is doing right now will go on for a long, long time, decades, and even longer. And I think one of the things that we tend, we Westerners, Americans, and foreigners in general outside of Russia, tend to overlook or not quite understand is what Putin is doing is not good for Russia. There's a lot of talk and a serious straining, a strain of argument that says that, well, Putin invaded Ukraine partly because the Western powers expanded NATO when Russia was weak, and that this is a sort of inevitable pushback that Putin is seeking to restore Russia's power, seeking to restore its influence in its own neighborhood, and that we should somehow try to understand that. Well, the fact is that what Putin is doing is bad for Russia's long-term interests. Isolating the country, now overseeing an economic recession after a decade and a half of boom, thanks to almost solely to rising oil prices. But that's something that we don't understand, that really what Putin is doing is in his self-interest. It's bad for the country. And I think that U.S. policy and Western policy in general has to keep that in mind, that Vladimir Putin isn't Russia, and that ultimately one of the goals of Western diplomacy, and especially public diplomacy, should be to try to convince Russians, try to make them help them see that really what Putin is doing is not beneficial to them or to their country's future.
With about a minute left, the administration spokesperson said the Obama administration would like to find a way to link arms with Russia on a diplomatic process and not have to tackle some of the less palatable issues like creating safe areas in Syria. Is that just dreaming to think there's a way to work with Russia on a diplomatic process?
I think it is dreaming. I think that's that's exactly the right thing to say, to characterize it. I think it's partly explained by the fact that we have a vacuum when it comes to Syria policy. There are no easy solutions in Syria, and as time goes on, any decision is increasingly hard. So I don't mean to make light of the situation. It's a very difficult decision about what to do in Syria. But having essentially no policy is no excuse. And here Putin is acting on the ground, sending his troops on the ground, and somehow pretends that this is to help our policy or to help ordinary Syrians. It's wishful thinking. Now, I don't mean to...
And we have to leave it there. Gregory, thank you so much for being with us. Oh, we have another minute. Oh, I'm sorry. I got lost on my time. Go ahead. Finish it. We got another minute, Gregory.
Terrific. Well, I just want to say, I don't mean to say that we shouldn't be talking with the Russians and that we should cut off communications. On the contrary, we should be doing everything to extend our hand, but we should be realistic about what the real motives are.
Thank you, Gregory, so much for being with us. When is the next book coming out?
I hope in the next couple of years, if the research goes well.
Good. Thank you. Gregory Pfeiffer, former Moscow correspondent for NPR. He's reported from Russia for about 10 years and author of Russians, The People Behind the Power, and working on a new book that we mentioned. We also want to thank for being with us earlier in the hour, Professor Mark Schrod, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Villanova University. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour and keeping track of time for me because I lost track of time. And thanks to KP for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. News is coming up from NPR, and David Marinus will join us to talk about Detroit in the year 1963. That's coming up next.